Good morning, everybody. So lovely to see so many folks here really taking up this this truly important matter. This Zen practice, this is what's called the great matter, the matter of life and death. This practice of showing up, this practice of intimacy with ourselves, this practice of service to all beings, support of each other. Doing this practice together that none of us can do alone. And one of the things, many of the things that support us in this practice are the forms and tools of Zen, the forms of the tradition and the roles of service. So we call our chanting portion of our program, we call it a service. We are serving. We are serving all beings. And if we're playing a drum or a bell or leading the chants in that service, we are serving all beings and serving the Sangha. These are ways to serve. And ways to give, which is sometimes called dana, which is a Sanskrit word that is the same root as the word that's come down in English as donation. And there are many ways to give, many ways to serve. And I really want to encourage you all to find the ways that you can serve. Some of it may be in Zendo things. Some of it may be elsewhere in your life. Some of it may be disposition of heart. But this practice of service, even if the way you are serving the Sangha is by sitting still and being intimate with this moment, that is also service. So I want to say, please sit comfortably. So this practice of showing up, this practice, and this Zen is part of Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism is also known as the Bodhisattva path, and the Bodhisattva is the one who vows to save all beings, and the one who prioritizes saving all beings above getting into any kind of state of lovely perfection for ourselves. We are opting back in to the big mess of being. This practice is not opting out of suffering. It's opting back in. So, when you find those struggles arising, that is it. Well done. Keep up that bodhisattva practice. So, I want to talk. So one of the forms that we use in the Zendo, one of the tools of Zen, one of the things that serves us and enables us to serve all beings is bowing. And Dogen, the founder of the Japanese Soto Zen tradition, says that as long as there is bowing, the Dharma cannot diminish. So, this Bowing is another name for service. This bowing is another name for intimacy. This bowing is another name for the coming together of the many as the expression of the one. This is what we are enacting, expressing with each gassho. And the spirit of everything we do, the spirit of everything we do in Zen is service, is bowing, is intimacy. Whether it's playing a drum, whether it's taking a step in kinhin, whether it's ringing a bell, inviting us more to inviting us to plunge into the period of Zazen, ringing a bell, inviting us to arise out of it. This is the spirit. And this is a practice of great love, great courage. And this practice of love isn't, doesn't mean we manufacture some state of mind. It means we allow our meeting of this moment, our meeting of this bell, our embodying this bow, to of itself be this expression of deep intimacy, of deep love. That is what we are doing. And so I'm going to talk, we're going to explore in a concrete and kind of detail-focused way some of the forms that we do. Now, in boundless way, we hold these forms lightly. We hold the right way of doing them lightly. And part of the spirit of this exploration today that I want to talk about is in the spirit of what one great 20th century Zen teacher said, he said, all of you are perfect just the way you are, and you can use a little improvement. And this is the spirit that I want to invite us to look at the instruments and the forms and the stuff of Zazen. So in boundless way, we hold these things loosely. And part of this is because this is essentially a lay sangha. Even those of us who are ordained are in an important way laymen. We have jobs, we have lives, we are householders. Householders is the name for lay people in traditional Buddhism. And we don't have monasteries, we don't have spaces dedicated only to this practice for the most part. So one of the great gifts of monastic practice, and there are many, but one of them is that it enables a real kind of just extensive over and over and over and over practice of various forms, and that enables a kind of refinement and precision to be able to come forth and be carried on. And in Soto Zen, in the purest form of Soto Zen, which isn't what we practice in boundless way, we're a kind of hybrid unicorn-like creature that baffles everybody. But in the purest form of Soto Zen, The way you do these forms and being able to master the forms is regarded as the full, complete, and highest expression of your practice. And you know, we've our Soto cousins, you know, one of them, in seeing the way that we hold these forms so lightly, she said to one of us, "So how do you know when somebody is practicing Zen? How do you know how people's practice are doing if you're not looking for perfection of forms?" And we practice this Zen of meeting our lives, this Zen of meeting each other, this Zen of meeting this big, clumsy, unrefined mess that is one of the symptoms of being human. This is how we roll. Because we're a lay sangha and we don't have that kind of monastic opportunity to practice and refine and refine and refine and maintain and transmit and polish those kinds of forms, ours are naturally more rough. And we find a balance between perfect just how it is. There's not a right way. There's not a wrong way. And there's a little bit more of a right way, and what if we try it like this? And meeting that tension of there's no right way, and also there's a right way. Holding both of those things, and it is the essential practice of Zen. And so that tension and that resonance and that provocation that you feel, is really important and is really a great gift of a thing to meet. And when any of us are asked to step into a new role, playing an instrument, being the timekeeper, leading Kinhin, coming forth with a talk, all of this is, in a real way, scary and provocative. And the opportunity to meet with that fear is one of the great gifts of this. And the opportunity to need to come forth and do something that you have never done before is a really important skill, because we often... Because there come times in our lives when we have to do that. And these service positions and roles and things like that, these are, on the one hand, immensely important. They are the very practice of saving all beings. They are holding and supporting the forms of the Dharma itself. Very, very important. And also, it's really quite a small, trivial thing. Here on a Saturday morning, ringing this bell three times, and how are you doing it? Is it good? That is not anything. And so the opportunity to meet with both of those things and to be able to practice this showing up to something that is new, unfamiliar, and very, very important, but also not that important. Being able to use the Dharma, your spiritual practice, as an opportunity to practice this very essential life skill. How wonderful. How wonderful. How great that your spiritual practice actually includes your life. So as we turn our attention to the liturgical practice forms, service pieces, I want to also add that part of the purpose of these things is to be provocative. Nearly everyone who comes to Zen for the first time, nearly everyone doesn't feel comfortable with the ritual, doesn't like the forms, has some reaction to the content or the tone or the style or the disharmony of the chants. And this is not a problem. This is a feature. Before we move into the detail focus segment, I wanted to see if Steve and Laura wanted to offer any comments.
Sure, thank you. When I first encountered Zen, the two things that I found most difficult were the bowing, particularly to the altar, and also this chanting. We had a new person the other night who was asking, so why is it that we do this chanting thing? And of course, there's a number of reasons why we do it. There's a lot of good teaching material in the chants that we do, and it gives us an opportunity to do them over and over again, and some of that to percolate through. But this practice itself of chanting has become for me one of the most important parts of my Zen practice that I really appreciate. The spirit, that we can bring to this chanting. I like to think of it as both giving and receiving. So I find that I'm actually able to kind of draw on the energy of the Sangha. I'm trying to listen to everyone's voice as we're chanting, and trying to blend my voice in with everyone else's. We all have our individual voices, right? Each one of us is a unique individual. But there's this wonderful opportunity in this practice for us to all join our individual voices together to create this one voice of our community. What a wonderful thing, to be able to hear each person in all of their uniqueness, and then to kind of feed on that and try and add my voice to this community voice. How can I add my unique expression and try and blend it into this one voice of all beings? It really is a kind of service activity, I think. And it's the same thing for me in ringing the bell or playing the drum. I'm trying to bring forth this thing into the world, the sound of the bell. And of course, when I'm doing that, I'm often noticing how, oh, that was a little too loud, that was a little too soft, and there's this disturbance that arises. Oh, I don't sound very good today, being with that too, this, as Josh was saying, this, we create these forms precisely so that there's this thing that we're supposed to be doing, and we're noticing how it isn't really going quite the way that I would like it to go, and how much like life that is. We're setting this arbitrary thing up that makes no difference whatsoever in one sense, and yet gives us this wonderful opportunity to see, what comes up for me when I don't hit the bell the way that I want to, or my voice doesn't sound the way that I would like it to. And how do I meet that, And how do I move beyond that? How do I continue to contribute to the community in spite of the fact that I don't sound very good today? And still I bring myself forward. It's a calling ourselves forward. Life calls us forward. How do we meet this situation? How do we save all beings given the meager resources that we have in this moment.
Yeah. And that's so well expressed. And I want to point out another way it might arise. So that's how it might arise of, boy, I'm really not doing this well. I don't sound the way I want. That's one way. The other way is, boy, I sound great, but really everybody else, man, that is some crap chanting. But you call that bell ring? God, I hate your bell ring. Jesus. That's another way it shows up. And we practice it exactly the same.
And people are counting on me. The bells mean something. They tell people when to stop. They tell them it's the last one. They did. No, all that stuff. No, I'm a crappy bell ringer. Straighten up. Get the next one right.
And Dogen has another phrase he talks about Zen practice as one continuous mistake. And this is especially true in the Zendo. This is especially true during service. This is especially true when we're ringing a bell. And this practice of Zen in general and liturgy practice in specific is a practice of touching the unconditional unconditioned enoughness of this moment, in touching, in meeting the perfection of even imperfection. And we make this vividly, vividly apparent as an opportunity with the instruments and with the services and all of that. So this practice of enoughness practice of letting it be perfect is one that we can do with ourselves, with our own chanting, with our own bell ringing, and also in hearing all of the mistakes, and really taking the opportunity to practice with the aversion of our own or other people's mistakes that arises, and letting that be included too in the enoughness, in the unconditional perfection. And the last thing I want to say about these forms is, although there is in a certain sense, a target that we're aiming at, this also is completely flexible with regard to what we can actually do with the body and mind we in fact have. And so all of the things that we're going to be talking about, if it is not possible for your body or mind to do those things, to let your body and mind express the heart of those things, the essence of those things, to practice this inwardly, nothing to do with outward form. And so sometimes I also talk about offering mind incense. It's not always possible to have a stick of incense and something to light it with, and to be able to light it and to let the smoke come out. Sometimes that's not possible. But there are times when offering incense is an important thing to do. And so we can offer mind incense. And that applies to all of these forms. One little movie reference. In the Lego movie? One of my favorite characters in that is Batman. And Batman's kind of a self-important, puffy dude in the movie. And at one point, they're in their thing, and they're trying to... They need to hit a button over there. And Batman takes out his little Batman throwing stars. And he throws one at it, and he misses. And he throws 15 more, and then he throws a whole bunch more. And then finally he hits it, and he goes... First try. So, this is our practice. I want to start... we're going to talk about forms, and all of these forms are a little bit... They're instantiated a little bit differently in each of the Boundless Ways and Sanghas. So even in Boundless Way, there's not a right. There's not a right way to do this no right way of forms. So, that said. I want to first talk about Gassho. Gassho, this is the coming together of the many as the one expressing itself through the many, just like the chanting, as Steve pointed to. This is an expression of... gratitude, of oneness, of appreciation. The palms should be together. The palms should be together, but not pressed. The elbows should be up, so not like this, and but not military like this. And the positioning, there's kind of a biometric positioning of this. Your hands should be one fist in front of your chin, and the top finger should line up with the bottom of your nose. So when we do a seated bow, we're doing it like this. And the point to place your attention is where the palms touch each other. And when you do a standing bow, all of this doesn't move. So it's just like that. The only moving is at the waist. So paying attention to not do that. And when we're doing and I'm going to demonstrate a standing bow too. So the standing bow, this bowing is an expression of oneness, an expression of appreciation. It is not a submission. It is not making yourself less than. And it also is an opportunity to embody letting go of making yourself greater than. So this bowing is a it's what one of the precepts calls meeting everything on equal ground. And so we do standing bows and we do full down to the floor prostrations. And any time that we do a full prostration, you are also welcome instead to do a standing bow. And these and if you're doing the standing bow, if you're doing the standing bow when we're doing the prostrations, do a prostration in your heart. So you can do a full prostration while standing. You can do walking meditation while sitting. So the full prostration, we will do that another time. That'll make me too self-conscious. But thank you for your thought and your appreciation of how we can serve the greater Sangha. So the bottom part of if we're doing a full prostration, and also if we're wearing a raksu, I wanna show that you tuck it in like that, hold it, and then go down. So and if you need to use the floor to get down, that is fine too. And then and then unfolding the feet, if this is possible for your body. So not keeping them like that, but unfolding them like that. And then, and here at the bottom, there is a micro moment of pause. So down with the forehead to the floor, and then palms up, raising your hands gently above the ears. And the hands are mostly flat, but not paying so much, but because of the nature of wrists and bodies, they're going to tilt a little bit in. So to try to let them be generally flat without too much strain. And this lifting up moment is is in a way what it is well, I don't know how to say that. But it's a elevation of our appreciation for this moment. So don't fling this moment back over your head. Really, there's something really beautiful to appreciate. in the bottom of this bow, whether we're doing it physically or in our hearts. Gentleness there. So I want to encourage us to stand up, and we will do some bows. And you can also stand up while seated and do these bows. And whether you do them with your body or your heart, please do this. This bell often accompanies our bows. I'm not going to do the whole run up, but do a full bow. I'm going to stand, but I'm going to invite you all to do a full bow. There's a beat of pause with your forehead to the floor, and there's a beat of pause beneath your hands. And this is really an opportunity to show up to this moment. So on the one hand, bowing is about something, and on the other hand, bowing is just the yoga of bowing. It's the bow posture, bow asana. So let's do one more. And again, remembering that the two strikes on anything like this generally means stand up if you're sitting or sit down if you're standing. And when we come to our we do a standing bow at the threshold of the zendo before we enter. Then when we walk to our seats, and here's something that I think is going to be news to most of you. When we're walking in the zendo, there's actually a mudra. There's actually a hand position for just wandering around, and the hand position is the same one that we do for kinhin, which is called shasu. One hand in a soft fist at about the level of the solar plexus, covered lightly by the other hand. And so any time you're walking in the zendo, this is actually the form. This is something we hold very loosely in Boundless Way, but it's something worth being aware of, and it's an additional way to kind of include every moment of our being as practice. You know, part of what these forms do, and part of what the posture of Zazen does, is remind us, hey, we're doing this thing, we're doing Zazen right now. And then we can notice our body and be like, oh yeah, right, Zazen. And the holding our hands in shashu for walking around in the zendo is also a reminder to practice and a appreciation and honoring of this space. So when we come in, we make a standing bow at the threshold of the zendo, and then we come over to our seats. And here's a form that I'm really trying to encourage here. Many of us, and this is less apparent today because there's so many folks here. How wonderfully! When there are fewer people, often what we see is the airport urinal approach to locating yourself in the Zendo, which is that you want to make sure you have a full buffer Zafu and Zabutan between you and the next closest person because, you know, you don't want to be too close to them for that kind of thing. I want to hold up that the Sangha is a totally different kind of endeavor than the airport urinal situation. So I really do want to encourage folks to sit next to a Sangha member, one of your Dharma brothers and sisters, whenever possible. And this is kind of an American thing, you know. This is also how we locate ourselves on a bus. You know, we want to make sure we have an entire row to ourselves, and we might even put something in the seat next to us just so nobody sits down there later. And so this is an opportunity to really appreciate the Sangha treasure, to really practice this intimacy and mutual support that is really only possible in the Sangha. So we come to our seat, and then we make a standing bow facing the seat, and we are bowing to the space, to the cushion that supports us, to the mat that we're going to sit on. We're bowing to the opportunity to meet ourselves. And when we do that, just as Steve did, the people directly to either side will return that bow with a standing bow if we haven't started a period of Zazen. If we have started a period of Zazen, you will still make those bows if you're coming to your cushion, but the other people won't return them. And then we turn around. And the way we turn depends on where we're standing in the Zendo. So if we're on this side of the Zendo, we turn one way, and if we're on that side of the Zendo, we turn the other way. And so part of this is to avoid aiming our butt at the altar. Not that there's anything wrong with our butt, and as one very famous koan states, you know, somebody asks a great master, what is Buddha? And the master says, use toilet paper. So, which is sometimes translated literally as dried shit stick. Even that is Buddha. Even that is Dharma. And this practice of the practice of these forms of how we do it are just ways of holding our heart with regard to these things, and B, encouraging us to come into awareness of this moment of turning. And regardless of which direction we're turning, we're always turning toward. This is the essence of Zen practice. Always turn toward. Even when turning away. So, standing over here, I just did that wrong, bowing and then turning like this. And if I were standing over here, bowing and then turning like that. And it's different for you guys if you're facing this way. So, turning, and then we make another standing bow. And this is to the Sangha that supports us, to the Sangha nearby. And people who are on either side, who are directly on either side, either on the next cushion or the next occupied cushion to that direction, will return that with a seated bow, if Zazen hasn't started. And uh, that was the first bow. The second bow is then the people behind us, across from us, and those will be returned by the row directly, the people in the row all the way back, and also to one on either side. So it isn't the case that every time somebody bows in the zendo, that bow gets returned by the entire zendo. So it's just those people right there. And you know, that's a kind of acknowledging the little mini sangha within a sangha of people right there. And this is something that's particularly vivid, you know, it's particularly easily seen on retreat, you know, where we have a specific kind of assigned location, and by the end of a retreat, even a short retreat, we feel very close to the people physically close to us, and there's a real kind of connection and intimacy there that is really lovely. And you've spent all you know about them is their feet usually, but you really connect to that. And so this is a way of expressing that and appreciating that with each other, and appreciating that this practice can only be done by all of us together. Or as Dogen says elsewhere, only by a Buddha with a Buddha. Only by Buddhas with Buddhas. It's becoming apparent to me there's no way whatsoever we're going to get through all of the stuff that I fantasize we might. But I want to talk about ringing bells. And ringing bells. So first of all, please never imagine you are hitting a bell or striking a bell. I really want to encourage all of us to meet the bell as another Sangha member, another being, a bell being, who supports our practice. And when we are ringing a bell, what we're actually doing is inviting it to sound, inviting it to come forth in its bell beingness. And the bells should, whether it's the timekeeper bell or the big bell or even the Incan, they should be rung with the breath and with the heart, not with the stick and with the wrist. So really important to connect to the breath and connect to this, to that gentleness. And I want to encourage any of you who ring a bell in any context, if you're first starting to ring a bell, or even later on, consider not chanting, so that you can give your entire attention to just ringing. So if you have to look at the sutra book to be able to chant, or if that pulls you away, give yourself the opportunity to just ring it. And when we hold this thing, holding it loosely and gently and flexibly, and for this bell, it's good to ring it on the inside, and letting it be a soft sound. And any time you hear a percussive hit at the beginning of the of your bell strike, then let that be an invitation to you to find this softness, love, and breath to ring it with. Perfectly. And each time it's an opportunity to bring our mind into that. I want to maybe let's put let's deploy these three bells, and let's go through and give everybody the opportunity to hit one of them. I want to actually just demonstrate on the timekeeper bell though. This one, it's often hard to get a soft, round sound. So before we do a little practicing with bells, I want to say about each of these bells, you know, so part of what the bell the Doan rings, this is bell is actually called a case, which is spelled K-E-S-U, and the U is silent. This bell kind of raises the energy, it fills the space, it holds, it's the container, the glue, the mortar of our service. And so this one is a energy raising kind of bell. And this bell, the timekeeper's bell, invites us, more and more, deeply into Zazen. So this bell should be rung slowly, letting the sound fade all the way out. All the way out. Because this one actually silences itself very quickly, so we let it where it went all the way out. Other bells, when it's a timekeeper, it's usually more like 85% out. And then at the end of the meditation period, it's two bells in quick succession, and they should be quick enough that you should never be, nobody should have the space to wonder, is there going to be a second strike or not? So at the end of the meditation period, if we're doing kinhin, there's two bells. And at the end of the meditation period, if we are not doing kinhin, there's just one bell. And part of the value of doing two bells like that is that then when we hear it, we can bow. And if those are spread out, it's unclear whether we're bowing after the first bell we hear or the second bell we hear. So what I want to do is pass these bells around the room, and I think maybe in a cacophonous style, We should just give everybody the opportunity to do this. So,
could I make one quick point before
yes.
we do on the Doan bell? So there's two kinds of strikes that we use on the Doan bell. There's the open, which is the dust, and then there's also a closed strike that Josh demonstrated by going like this with the hand, and that's fine. The thing that we want to avoid when doing this is using the striker flat like this and hitting the handle. So it'll make an awful clunking sound when the handle is used on the bell, and the handle should never actually touch the bell itself. So we do the closed strike. There's various ways it could be done, like this or like that, or I find it easiest to still hit it in basically the same manner as the open strike, where you're hitting the edge of the bell like this and also using the hand to damp it, so like that. And it should make a solid sound, but not that clunk of the wood hitting metal.
Yeah, this one does have a kind of sharp percussive quality to it at that point. So let's just circulate these three bells around and take the opportunity to explore this. Or the same directions but different places.
Okay.
With the large bell, do three three kind of energy raising invitations to ring with the medium-sized bell. The three slowly spaced out ones, and with the tiny bell, do the two end of a period ones, ding ding. So these will just go and just have this experience. See what it's like for you. And don't be concerned about right and wrong, but just explore. So carry on, big make a noise, everybody. With all of the bells, err on the side of softness. But if it's too soft, if it's soft and not kind of energy holding, then see if you can bring a little more energy and a little more volume, but no more violence to it. So this is also a practice of continuous self-correction. Tiniest bell, we're using it as if it's the medium-sized bell. But when we in the liturgy service, when we ring that one, we do it in response to each name that we do a special dedication for. Maybe the case should go to this end. Because those other ones over there. We're using the tiny bell in response to each of the names that we do a special dedication for, and that kind of like gives that expression, that name, wings. It kind of sends it out, kind of with strength and energy into the world. And what we're communicating is, like I honor you with each of those strikes. Each of those soundings. So important to let these bells also mean something. Let's just keep moving it and nobody will play it. The three strikes are nearby because we're building that energy at the beginning of a service. And you know, one of the other things that's so interesting about these bells, you know, if you've been practicing this stuff for a little while, they have such associations, you know, and Yeah, and I'm noticing what rises up in me each time I hear all of these bells, you know, and so it's a beautiful way too. We do these bells in the service together, so we can also do them elsewhere. We can do them at home. We can do them by ourselves, you know, and they still create for us this. They kind of hold and holographically manifest the stuff that they do when we do them together as a sangha. So we can kind of create that sangha invisibly. Yeah, so it's not the Mokugyo, it's the Han.
Oh, yeah.
It's the wooden thing. That we hear that on Sesshin, and that's the thing that kind of starts 10 minutes in advance of when we're supposed to be in the Zendo. And that calls us, that kind of fills the space, it goes up the mountain, it goes to wherever you are, so you know, oh right, here we're here to gather. And then at the Zendo in monasteries, it's often the case that there's a very large bell that is rung slow prior to the service beginning to kind of call the energy and hold the space. We don't do it like that, although you can hear those things at Sesshin.
Has everyone had a chance with these?
I want to talk a little bit about, has everyone had the big bell? Excellent. I want to talk a little bit about kinhin, about walking meditation. Kinhin, walking meditation, is something we can do seated, if that is what is right for our body. If it's possible, and so if you're doing zazen, or if you're doing walking meditation, seated, be doing walking meditation in your heart. If your body is able to participate by doing the walking form of walking meditation, you're encouraged to do that. So in this practice, when we do walking meditation, some people who have practiced in other traditions feel that in Boundless Way, our Zazen periods are too short, and they don't let you get into those special, ultra excellent, super focused and still mind spaces. That is one of the things that human beings can do sometimes under some circumstances. And again, this isn't a bug, this is a feature. Our practice is not about special states, only infrequently accessible. And so taking the practice from the stillness of Zazen into the motion of Kinhin is the first step in taking our practice from the specialness of the Zendo into the big mess of our lives. And we do Kinhin, we do walking meditation to kind of remind ourselves, teach ourselves, and see that this practice isn't about stillness. This practice is something we can do in any place in our life. So when we're doing walking meditation, we are bringing our attention again and again back to the physicality of walking, to the physicality of walking that includes the physicality of breath. This is the spirit in which we practice Zazen, in which we practice Kinhin. And the form of Doksan, the individual meetings, that requires us to take the practice of Zazen out of the sphere of silence and into the sphere of verbal expression as well. Out of the sphere of solitude and into the sphere of the interpersonal. And all of these are so that we are becoming more skilled and more able to be able to bring the tools and the value of these teachings into the rest of our lives. And when we do walking meditation, just like Steve was saying about the chanting of the many voices expressing the one sangha, and the one sangha being expressed through many voices, the same is true with the bodies and the feet in Kinhin. It's this one centipede like body expressing itself with each of these feet. And so to include the entirety of the moving sangha in your practice of Kinhin. And one element of Kinhin is awareness of kind of walking and stepping in a generally together fashion. So moving at the same kind of the same-ish pace as the rest of the sangha, and with bringing a little teeny bit of light care and peripheral attention into letting us all walk with one side and then the other side, right foot and left foot. Not always, so I want to encourage people to not do that in a slavish fashion that makes just stepping left and then stepping right the entirety of the practice. And so again, we're aiming at this moving, unhittable target of all walking with the left foot, all riding with the right foot, while still kind of honoring the our own natural pace and breath, and missing entirely and hitting it with the first try. And in Kinhin, this is also a practice of intimacy, of oneness, and of not meeting with the interpersonal space in the same way. So we position ourselves so that we're about a forearm's length in front of the person in front of us. And this requires continual maintenance, because our tendency is going to be to slide back. And so continually reapproaching and becoming part of that one centipede body. And to get a sense of that that distance, you know, you can imagine being close enough to be able to hang on to the back of the shirt of the person in front of you.
Just a question. Just because, you know, someone who has a long stride, that requires one to at least make shorter strides.
Right. So the length of strides in this is, it's the middle way. So being not taking some ways of practicing Kinhin, you lift your foot up and you move it one half of a foot length in front of it, and then another one, so it's this teeny thing. Another, there's also ways of practicing this walking meditation, where it's very brisk, in a way that feels to me, it starts out very slow, and then it goes very brisk in a way that feels that I'm late and I really need to be somewhere. And we are practicing a single moderate pace, and paying attention to moving towards the middle way. Not too long, not too short. And this is why the objective of everybody walking with the left foot and then everybody walking with the right foot is only vague and a thing to aim at. There's going to be a certain amount of, you know, the fact that all of us are doing our things with our individual bodies, that the naturalness changes, but the invitation, you know, so like, what do something that's natural to you, but the invitation is also to move towards being able to do it harmoniously with the Sangha in general. Yeah, sure. In some traditions, it's true that there are specific instructions, in our style, So I think we're going to wrap up there, and this is part one of, I'm guessing, three. Of these kinds of things, and the next one will be sometime in the indefinite future. But I really want to encourage you to really open your heart to these forms, to explore this practice of one continuous mistake, and to come early for any time you come, so that there's an opportunity for you to learn a little bit more of the details about how to do one of the service positions. So our goal is to be continuously training people who don't know how to do the details of any of these service positions and doing it. Sometimes that's not possible because of time and people coming in late, and so we give it to somebody who already knows. But our aspiration is to always at least be teaching one person one new position each time. So let's wrap up with one more Bodhisattva vows. The inside back cover. And those of you who are here for the first time, this isn't ordinarily how our Saturday morning stuff goes. This is an unusual form of a program.